staff gathered in Omaha to write the first PSYOP, under tremendous pressure to complete it within 4 months. Their process would be as rational, impersonal, and automated as possible. The first step was to create a national strategic target list. They began by poring through the Air Force's Bombing Encyclopedia, a compendium of more than 80,000 potential targets located throughout the world. The book gave a brief description of each target, its longitude and latitude and elevation, its category, such as military or industrial, airfield or oil refinery, and its BE number, a unique 8-digit identifier. From that lengthy inventory, 12,000 candidates in the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, and China were selected. A target weighing system was adopted to measure their relative importance. Every target was assigned a certain number of points. Those with the most points were deemed the most essential to destroy. And the National Strategic Target List, as a whole, was given a total value of 5 million points. All of this data, the BE numbers, the target locations, and the numerical points were fed into SAC's latest IBM computer. What emerged was a series of desired ground zeros containing multiple targets at which America's nuclear weapons would be aimed. Once the target list was complete and the ground zeros identified, the planners calculated the most efficient way to destroy them. A wide assortment of variables had to be taken into account, including the accuracy and reliability of different weapons systems, the effectiveness of Soviet air defenses, the impact of darkness or poor weather, and the rate at which low-flying aircraft were likely to crash due to unknown causes, known as the clobber factor. The Joint Chiefs specified that the odds of a target being destroyed had to be at least 75%, and for some targets, the rate of damage assurance was put even higher. Achieving that level of assurance required cross-targeting, aiming more than one nuclear weapon at a single ground zero. After the numbers were crunched, the PSYOP often demanded that a target be hit by multiple weapons, arriving from different directions at different times. One high-value target in the Soviet Union would be hit by a Jupiter missile, a Titan missile, an Atlas missile, and hydrogen bombs dropped by 3 B-52s, simply to guarantee its destruction. The PSYOP would unfold in phases. The alert force would be launched within the first hour, the full force in waves over the course of 28 hours. And then the PSYOP ended. The Strategic Air Command was responsible for striking most of the ground zeros. Tactics programmed for the PSYOP are in two principal categories, the head of the Joint Chiefs later explained, the penetration phase and the delivery phase. SAC would attack the Soviet Union front to rear, hitting air defenses along the border first, then penetrating more deeply into the nation's interior and destroying targets along the way, a tactic called bomb as you go. Great Britain's strategic weapons were controlled by the PSYOP as well. The Royal Air Force showed little interest in SAC's ideas about counterforce. The British philosophy of strategic bombing had changed little since the Second World War, and the RAF's Bomber Command wanted to use its nuclear weapons solely for city-busting. The PSYOP respected the British preference, asking Bomber Command to destroy 3 air bases, 6 air defense targets, and 48 cities. George Kistakowsky, the president's science advisor, visited SAC headquarters in November 1960. To get a sense of how work was proceeding on the PSYOP. Kistakowsky was hardly a peacenik. He'd fled the Soviet Union as a young man, designed the high-explosive lenses for the Trinity device, and later shared the Air Force's concerns about a missile gap. But he was shocked by the destructiveness of the PSYOP. The damage levels caused by the alert force alone would be so great that any additional nuclear strike seemed like unnecessary and undesirable overkill. Kistakowsky thought that the full force would deliver enough megatons to kill 4 and 5 times over somebody who was already dead, and that SAC should be allowed to take just one whack not 10 whacks at each Soviet target. Nevertheless, he told Eisenhower, I believe that the presently developed PSYOP is the best that could be expected under the circumstances, and that it should be put into effect. At the beginning of the effort to devise a new war plan, Eisenhower had expressed opposition to any strategy that required a 100% pulverization of the Soviet Union. He could still remember when the Pentagon said the Soviets had no more than 70 targets worth destroying. There was obviously a limit, he told his national security staff, a human limit to the devastation which human beings could endure. On December 2, 1960, Eisenhower approved the PSYOP without requesting any changes. The PSYOP would take effect the following April. It featured 3,729 targets, grouped into more than 1,000 ground zeros that would be struck by 3,423 nuclear weapons. The targets were located in the Soviet Union, China, North Korea, and Eastern Europe. About 80% were military targets, and the rest were civilian. Of the urban industrial complexes scheduled for destruction, 295 were in the Soviet Union and 78 in China. The PSYOP's damage and casualty estimates were conservative. They were based solely on blast effects. They excluded the harm that might be caused by thermal radiation, fires, or fallout, which were difficult to calculate with precision. Within 3 days of the initial attack, the full force of the PSYOP would kill about 54% of the Soviet Union's population and about 16% of China's population, roughly 220 million people. Millions more would subsequently die from burns, radiation poisoning, exposure. The PSYOP was designed for a national emergency when the survival of the United States was at stake, and the decision to launch the PSYOP would carry an almost unbearable weight. Once the PSYOP was set in motion, it could not be altered, slowed, or stopped. The PSYOP soon became one of the most closely guarded secrets in the United States. But the procedures for authorizing a nuclear strike were kept even more secret. For years, the Joint Chiefs had asked not only for custody of America's nuclear weapons, but also for the authority to use them. In December 1956, the military had gained permission to use nuclear weapons in air defense. In February 1959, the military had gained custody of all the thermonuclear weapons stored at